Welcome to your fourth class on the history of Britain since the Romans, and we're in the middle of the Reformation. Well, the Reformation is, I guess, coming to its final stages, and the important one with James was the refusal of the millenary petition, so refusing to go further into Protestantism, to move further away from the ritual and hierarchy which the Church of England had inherited from Catholicism. And secondly, but almost accidentally, ordering a new translation of the Bible. And in fact, translating the Bible is very political, because it's very old. There's a lot of argument about, does this translate like this or like that? And so you can choose the translations which fit better your idea of what Christian doctrine should be. And they did have it was an amazing story, actually. They had a big fight about, oh, this means this. Oh, no, it'd be better to translate. So certainly politics was in there, but it was also a literary masterpiece. So even today, it is, you know, that when people quote the Bible from memory, it's very often the King James Bible. Yes, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the man came, sent from God, and his name was John, but it wasn't me. And I mentioned some of the aspects there. The Holy Bible, containing the Old and New Testaments, translated out of the original tongues, and with the former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special command, appointed to be read in churches. Yeah, each church cannot choose the translation they have. They've got to use this one. And this is part of stabilizing the Church of England, which was mostly done by Elizabeth, but it still has to happen. And yet, at the same time as this, James was increasingly in conflict with Parliament. Because the Parliament, more and more power, but wanted more still. And so James, and the move to Protestantism was aligned with the idea of less absolute power for the king. And so as James was more tempted by using more power, he was also more tempted by Catholicism. These two things went together. But he didn't stay around for that long. He was king from till 1625, and he was there. You go. That's the King James Bible, and he was the he was replaced by Charles I. And as you know, we again they again have a King Charles in Britain. But it was a rather unfortunate name, really, because the first guy, he's king in 1625, and in 1649 he is executed by the Parliament. Okay, so yeah, we can say that didn't go too well. Now, I say to 1649, that's kind of official, but really, in the last 7 years after 1642, during the Civil War, he was not effectively king. He still thought he was king, but it was very much a contested situation, let's say. So what is Charles most noted by? First of all, he will be moving towards absolutism, being tempted by absolutism. In particular, at this time, the Parliament meets when the king decides. And when the king is unhappy with it, then he dissolves the Parliament. The king has a right to call and to dissolve the Parliament. The Parliament's job is to advise the king. And the Parliament does not represent democracy, although because it's only rich people who are represented there, but nevertheless it represents the opposite of absolutism. He also moved to defending Catholics. There's still some Catholics in Britain. And he was defended by Catholics, and people began to think that he had converted to Catholicism. This was true. He had secretly converted to Catholicism. And there was a series of conflicts with the parliaments that Charles would call the Parliament because he needed money. You see, the Parliament, it was the Parliament's job to vote taxes, and Charles needed money for war in particular. The Parliament was not cooperating. And in particular, certain members of Parliament were being very critical of the king. And this became more and more of an argument until the day when the king arrived in Parliament himself with armed soldiers and said, I want these five men, these five MPs who were his biggest critics. And the Speaker of the Parliament, le Président de la Chambre, said words which have become famous since. He said, Sir, I have neither ears to hear nor tongue to speak except as commands me this House. Yeah, I'm not telling you where they are, because I only represent the house, and I have neither ears to hear nor tongue to speak except as commands this house. This is not the exact translation, which I forgot, the exact quotation, which I forgot, but a beautiful thing. This is bad news for the king. He said, hey, I'm the king, you're my subject, what the fuck? Yeah, that's what he said, approximately. He went away. The five members of parliament had found out in advance and were hiding somewhere. Good idea. And so he went away, and then the parliament voted. They voted to have an armed guard in front of the parliament to protect the parliament from the king. Now, in theory, the parliament is there to advise the king. So really, this is symbolically the beginning of civil war. That is basically what happened. People hesitated. People always hesitate before starting a civil war, because it's a really messy thing. Yeah, but eventually it seemed there was no option, and Charles went to Oxford, and he raised his standard in Oxford. He said, everybody who is willing to fight for the king against the parliaments, well, he probably said against the rebels, come to Oxford and we'll get our army together. And he did. He got a traditional army together. Now, the traditional armies were rather different from today. For example, you know, if you were the general or the next person down, it depended on which family you came from. It was very based on aristocratic ideology. And on the parliamentary side too, then they also raised an army. This shook up the entire country. You know, we're fighting against the king, but you don't fight against kings. It's very difficult. It was very difficult for people to imagine, and certainly this encouraged many, many political rebels and dissenters, who we sometimes call sects. Now, a sect is just a small religion, really. Remember, I was telling you that if you thought you needed a different society at the time, you also thought you needed a different religion. You said, we need a different society because that's what God wants. This was the normal way of talking. And so there were a rising influence of different sects, some of them absolutely wonderfully poetic, and some of them a little bit more influential. Here we have, for example, The Diggers. This is one example. The Diggers, this is one of the far left sects, like early communists, if you like, and they were led by Gerard Winstanley, and this is what he said: England is not a free people till the poor that have no land have a free allowance to dig and labour the commons. So he said, you know, it's not a free people because there are people who have no land, and that's not right. Everybody should have access to land. Now, as you can imagine, the elite were not too happy with this. So this was a religious group, but that was the basis of it. The more influential group was the Levellers. They took their name from a British pop group. No, they didn't. It was the other way around. The Levellers were very, very influential political group. In a way, they were a political movement and also a religious one. Levellers, their critics said, you want everybody at the same level. Shock, horror, yeah? So they would become very influential. Yeah, there you go, the Levellers. Yeah. A manifestation from these people, styled Levellers, intended for their full vindication from the many... So this is a defence of the Levellers. And there were hundreds and hundreds of pamphlets written by different groups saying, hey, this is... Okay, we've got rid of... The king is not so good. This is the kind of society we want. Hundreds of them. In particular, several groups led by women were in the radical... Many of them were fighting for democracy. Now today we think democracy, oh yeah, well that's what everybody wants. At the time, democracy is an extreme ridiculous, godless idea to most people. So there's some wonderful books written about the women's groups who were organised around this. We call this the English Civil War, but it's also sometimes been called the English Revolution. Because it shakes up the whole society. And as one famous revolutionary said, the revolution is the festival of the oppressed. It's the time when everybody suddenly gets the chance to say what they think. Now Cromwell, who was the leader of the parliamentary side. The leader of the military on the parliamentary side. So you've got people like the Levellers, and they are, if you like, the most radical of the parliamentary side. Now, the parliamentary side is very, very varied. A lot of the elite on the parliamentary side say, well, we need to oblige the king to make a compromise. And there are other ones who say, no, we need a new king. And there's a small minority who says, oh, we don't need a king. That's how it will go. In any case, Cromwell, the leader on the parliamentary side, is a little bit like Robespierre in France, in that he understands that if he only mobilizes the elite, he will lose. And the only way to win against the king is to mobilize the people. And how do you mobilize the people? Well, in general, by underlining, we're not just fighting against the king. We want you to come and risk your life to fight for a new society, an entirely new society. And indeed, the new model army was the army that, that again, it's all pop groups as well, but yeah, the new model army was the army that Cromwell built. Very, very radical. For in many places, they elected their own officers. I don't know if any of you have been in the army, but I can assure you that they do not elect the officers these days. Yeah. So very, very. The army was a radical democratic force. It was a place where people could discuss, and it was the force which was wanting the most radical change. So this is basically what happened. The green is the parliamentarians, and as you can see. Things go forward and backwards, and then the parliamentarians win. Okay. Interestingly enough, the centre of influence for the king is Oxford. Oxford and the aristocrats. London is for Parliament. London is commerce. The new classes are based in London. That's where the money is. And the landowners tended more to support the king. In any case, during the... I just had one more there. I took this photograph. No, I didn't take this photograph. I saw this monument accidentally a couple of years ago. And this is a monument in Wigan. It's a town in the north of England. Because this is where Gerald Winstanley was born. He was the leader of the Diggers. And the Diggers actually went for direct action. They got together a whole load of peasants who had no land, and they took over land which in theory belonged to the king, and they started farming it. Now, of course, they eventually the army came and killed them all, but it was a tremendous symbol. And there's a very well-known song, "The World Turned Upside Down," a folk song about this moment. So inside the army, a lot of debates about what to do. Shall we compromise with the king? Do we need a new king? In particular, there were the Putney debates. That is, that Oliver Cromwell, who was the leader of the army, was obliged to organise a series of debates with the Levellers at Putney to say, "Yeah, well, you know, what should we do with the king, and what kind of society do we want?" And again, this is, you know, when you can oblige your general to organise a debate. That's pretty cool. In any case, those who thought we needed to get rid of the king won out, and the king was executed in 1649. Now they had a trial. They called up a whole load of judges, and they phoned them up, and they didn't phone them up. They tried to get judges, and the judges like, "Oh no, I'm sorry, I have to repaint my bathroom that weekend. I can't come." many, many judges were thought that this was not such a great idea to come. But they did eventually get a few judges, and he was found guilty, and he was executed. And so we find ourselves with the English Republic. The English Republic will last 11 years, but of course you can choose what to call it. If you go to the Tower of London, which is really, it has crowns and diamonds and stuff, and it's also got a long corridor with portraits of every king. And after Charles the First, and before Charles the Second, what can you see? Nothing. Nothing at all. They don't mention it. It's what the conservative historians call the interregnum, between two kings. Historians call it in different ways. These 11 years are called by conservative historians the interregnum. By most historians, the Commonwealth. That was the official name, the Commonwealth. Commonwealth, Richesse Commune, just like Republic, Res Publica. But you can call it the English Republic if you wish. And this is a reenactment of these are the parliamentarians, well known under the name of Roundheads, whereas the Cavaliers were the supporters and the soldiers of the king. Now there were two. Why did Cromwell win? Why did Charles lose? Mainly it was about Cromwell recruiting ordinary people. Indeed, he said Cromwell said, "You need to get men of spirit. Such people were likely to be middling folk or even common men." So Cromwell, when he said he had a new model army, what that meant is you have an army and you put the best military men at the top, not the most aristocratic. This is the traditional way. If you're an aristocrat, you're at the top because you're an aristocrat. And so he did in the new way. Parliament carried on making different reforms. They abolished bishops and various other things. And in any case, Cromwell will be the symbol of the end of absolute monarchy in Britain. As we will see, the monarchy will come back, but they will never have any chance of being absolute monarchs again. This is then 120 years before the French Revolution. And the only way in France I don't want to get into French history, partly because I don't know enough about it, but let's say it, because it was later in France, it was more explosive. And because it was earlier in England, they found this compromise, which I will talk about in a moment. In any case, Cromwell, so fascinatingly enough, I remember discovering this statue of Cromwell. It's just outside the Houses of Parliament in London. And I'm thinking, you know, you've got the statue of Cromwell, and just over there, statues of kings. And, you know, shouldn't people be annoyed about it or something? But you know, apparently he became just like Robespierre. You know, Robespierre, the elite hated Robespierre in 1830, and now they name metro stations after him. You know, so things can change as history goes on. So there's Cromwell. So what did Cromwell do? Those are the important dates. It's pretty difficult to execute a king, but when you do, you need some sort of constitution, some sort of structure. It was not easy to stabilize a new structure. Cromwell did not want to be king. He was against the idea of having kings. But there was not... What other countries did later, when they got rid of their kings, is they had a look at the French Revolution. Well, what did they do in the French Revolution? Let's use bits of the French constitution. But they couldn't do that because it was too early. And in any case, over the next few years, there were three constitutions in Britain. The first one was called the Instrument of Government. The second one was the Rule of the Major. So there was, let's say, three structures of government. The first one under the Constitution, the Instrument of Government. 2 years later, they instituted regional military rule under the Rule of the Major Generals, some of whom were women. 2 years later again, another constitution. Now, if you have three constitutions in 6 years, this is not good. Yeah, it means it's not stabilising, it's not working out. And so they did seem to have great difficulties about about stabilizing it. They had the New Republic had lots of enemies. On the right, there were royalists and semi-royalists, but also they had lots of enemies on the left, people who thought we wanted much more from the overthrowing of the old order. So there's a lot of events and a lot of difficulties, which I can't go into, but eventually in 1660, a section of the elites wrote to Charles II. Charles II is the son of Charles I. Well, he wasn't Charles II, but he was the son of Charles I at the time. And he was living probably in France or somewhere like that, somewhere with a king. And they wrote to him and said, you know, will you come back? And he did. And you got the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 under Charles II, who then continued for 25 years to be king. However, as one scholar said at the time, what has been written with the sword cannot be wiped out by the pen. Charles came back on the condition that he was absolutely not monarch. He was not allowed to make his own taxes. In fact, a few years later, they passed a law that said the king will receive a salary from Parliament. It wasn't called a salary, it was called the civil list. But yeah, so you could see that it's very British. It appears to be the same, and it's completely different. That's what British people do. We did it with the House of Lords. You know, the House of Lords today has almost no aristocrats in it. But we keep the same name because we like doing stuff like that. So the restoration was, in theory, to recognise that Charles II had been king since the day his father was executed. Now, this was very expensive because Charles II had a lot of debts. But in any case, the most important thing is that the king accepted to relinquish a lot of different rights to taxes. He said, OK, I won't do that, and I'll just receive a salary from Parliament. So he was dependent on Parliament. Now, a lot of the Cavaliers, a lot of the Royalists were unhappy with this. They were unhappy with the compromise, and in particular with the Declaration of Breda. The Declaration of Breda made it possible for the king to come back. And it said, if you fought against us in the Civil War, we are proclaiming an amnesty. We will not be imprisoning or executing or repressing those people who fought against the king in the Civil War. This was, if he didn't sign this, he wasn't coming back. Yeah, so this was the deal. But he did make an exception. He said, except for the small group of a few dozen people who voted for the death of the king. And indeed, there were a few of them. Most of them had died already. Cromwell, of course, was already dead, and so Charles II ordered that they dig up his body, cut it into four pieces, and exhibit the four pieces in the four parts of London. Il y en a qui sont... Quel est le mot que je cherche là? Rancunier. Il y en a qui sont rancunier. Okay. So we had the king back, but in a different term. The other thing that they did... In fact, there were nine. The Charles I death warrant had been signed by 60 people, and nine of the 60 signatures were executed. But the bodies of Cromwell and two more were dug up and cut to pieces. And indeed, his body was dug up. He had been buried in Westminster Abbey, because he was the head of state. I went to Westminster Abbey a few weeks ago. And there's a little plaque here. Cromwell was buried here from 1651 to 1660. You know, for a few years, he was here. Now that is a tremendous simplification. In any case, the Parliament was incontestably the boss now. And this involved a lot of exclusion of Catholics. One of the ways that they stabilized the new situation and tried to make absolutism impossible was by excluding Catholics, not allowing Catholics to have any positions of influence. Now, nevertheless, the king and after him his brother, I think it's James II, I'm pretty sure, his brother, were still kind of nostalgic about the old days and became a little bit too interested in defending Catholics. And so in 1688, there was a new crisis, and the Parliament wrote to William of Orange, a prince from Holland, and said, "Yeah, please invade England and become our king." So basically the Parliament sacked the king and chose another one in 1688. This is what is known as the Glorious Revolution, and as one scholar said, it was neither a revolution nor was it glorious. William of Orange invaded England with a small army, and James II got his army in London and marched out to meet them. And on his way, he discovered that his sister had joined the other army. I hate it when sisters do that. It's just such an awful thing to do. In any case, there was very little fighting, and James II was allowed to run away to France. The Glorious Revolution of 1688, followed in 1689, I think, by the Bill of Rights, completely stabilised this situation where Parliament is boss, and that's the end of that. And this was useful because, from the point of view of the new commercial classes and the slow rise of capitalism in its modern form with banks and private companies, they managed much better with Parliament. The problem with the king is that it really was the king's personal opinion. So suddenly the king would say, "Oh yeah, no, we're going to ban these exports just because I feel like it." And commerce doesn't work well like that. Commercial classes, the new bourgeoisie, they like things to be predictable. They're prepared to pay taxes, but they want to know that next year's tax is the same as this year's, or they know what's happening. And so that led us to the end of the Reformation and the Civil War period. Of course, the English are very proud of the fact that we executed our king 100 years before you executed your king. Actually, most English people are probably not that proud. A lot of English people didn't even know. I know that when I was at school, I think it's better now, but when I was at school, the history teaching was incredibly bad. We did like the 15th century and then the 19th century, and nothing between. It was just really bizarre. So moving on to then the next topic. I think I will